Now, President Trump signed an executive order yesterday outlining the administration's response to nationwide protests over racism and policing. The order encourages police departments to undergo new training on use of force and to use outside experts in areas like mental health to serve as co-responders. The order got pushback from criminal justice advocates who say it does little to address things like systemic racism in law enforcement. Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and a faculty associate at the school's Frank J. Remington Center and the La Follette School of Public Affairs. Cecilia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What stands out to you in this White House executive order? Do you see it as effective? Not much. Where does this fall?
I think that the executive order can't do all the things that people want it to do in terms of reforming policing, because in the United States, policing is primarily a local matter. The 18,000 law enforcement agencies in this country operate primarily at the local and state levels, not at the federal level, which limits in many ways what the federal government can do to improve our confidence in policing.
Yeah, some of what we see from the president and some of the proposals in Congress either offer incentives and grants if police, local police departments do things, or threaten to limit federal funding if they don't do things. Is that really the leverage that the federal government has, the purse strings?
Indeed. It's the power of the purse that is the primary mechanism by which the federal government is able to incentivize or punish police for engaging in certain kinds of public policy. The federal government can also engage in litigation, which is continues to be done and has been done more robustly in the past against police agencies that are seen as repeatedly violating civil rights. But the main power are the billions of dollars that the Department of Justice annually awards to police agencies in the form of grants.
Let's get into that power of lawsuits. We had seen in the past this idea of consent decrees used in the Obama administration in particular, dialed back under the Trump administration. Can you talk about these consent decrees and what they do?
Sure. So consent decrees are really negotiated agreements between two parties in a lawsuit that have been given sort of a stamp of approval by a court. They are usually the way that large-scale litigation against government institutions, schools, prisons, police agencies are resolved, where the parties come together and often without conceding error, sometimes with a concession, will agree to engage in certain kinds of reform-oriented actions, and the failure to engage in those actions can be enforced by a court's order.
Can you talk about the trajectory of those from the Obama era to the Trump era?
I can speak a little bit to that, although it falls a little bit outside my focus of specialized research. But certainly in the Obama era, there was a lot of attention to the power of the Department of Justice to bring lawsuits in communities where police had a history of engaging in excessive force. In order to give, oftentimes, agencies that themselves were interested in reform some political cover to agree to make large-scale changes that sometimes were quite costly. There has been some retrenchment from that kind of active litigation in the Trump administration, and obviously that generates a lot of political controversy. Whether litigation is one of the key ways of reforming police is something people disagree on quite vehemently.
Cecilia Klingel is with us, associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, looking at efforts at police reform, an executive order from the president, efforts in Congress as well. Cecilia, from various kind of police reforms and community reforms that you've looked at, do we know what's effective in helping prevent incidents like the George Floyd killing that sparked all of this protest?
I think that we know a lot, and the answer is that there is no one answer. Changes can begin with the recruitment and the training, and then continue to the supervision of officers. We know that policies make a big difference. We know that resources make a difference. But I think that one of the big questions we really have to answer at this time is whether what we want is more police who are better trained, who know about mental health, who understand substance use disorders, all of the things that the executive order is promoting here, or whether what we want is less policing. We want to take some of the tasks police are currently charged with and give them over to other agencies, often human service agencies, and shrink the duties of the police. And I think that is a question we have to be ready to answer in order to decide the best way to move forward.
And that's a huge question. I mean, I've talked to police departments and advocates who say we need police officers to have better training to deal with people having mental health crises. I think a lot of people are behind that. But other people are saying we need to unbundle it so that somebody other than a police officer is dealing with mental health issues. That's a really fundamental decision. Do we have case studies? Do we have evidence of people who have tried that unbundling approach in the United States or elsewhere?
There are limited and isolated examples of taking particular police functions and turning them over, particularly to mental health agencies or providers. You'll see in the executive order, there's an attempt to sort of strike a middle ground by promoting grants for cooperative response teams that would involve social workers and police officers or mental health workers and police officers. One of the challenges, of course, is that often police don't know what the problem is until they arrive on the scene, given the way that we currently allocate police resources. Civilians pick up the phone, dial 911, and summon the armed power of the state, as a former policing friend used to put it. And I think that that is, again, one of the questions we should ask ourselves is whether that is how we think police power ought to be allocated.
Now, we see some of the efforts really targeting specific things, including the idea of limiting chokeholds. Training standards proposed by President Trump would ban chokeholds, quote, except if an officer's life is at risk. Given the danger we've seen of chokeholds, not just in the George Floyd situation, but Eric Garner and others, is it worth that kind of tight focus on this one police tactic?
Well, certainly the use of force more broadly needs to be reexamined. It is already a subject of police training. Many agencies have reformed their policies over the past decade quite considerably, and most departments today either severely limit or ban chokeholds. It is a piece of what we need to pay attention to. Too many people have died as a result of the abuse of that restraint. But obviously, the questions and the problems we have are much larger than just that one issue.
Another issue protesters are raising is concerns about systemic racism in police departments. Given the difficulties of solving systemic racism in society at large, are there things that you think could be effective in the police context?
There are always ways that all of us, whether you're talking about university professors or media personalities like yourselves or the police, could be improving our understanding of racism and the ways in which we may intentionally or unintentionally be contributing to it. There's been a lot of work done in how we can do that as a broader community and for police as well. But again, these changes, there's not one single magic fix. It's going to take a rethinking of what we are asking police to do and then how we want to prepare them to do that task in a way that's fair to everyone in our community.
I think it's easy as a policymaker to want that one quick fix or four or five things. Do you think we have, given, you know, the, as you said, dispersed nature of police control in the United States, do we have the attention span to try to come up with a thoughtful, you know, fundamental, broad-ranging fix here?
I mean, the attention span of the American people is a challenge to reform at every level of government and in private life as well, I think. But yes, I think that this is an issue that has been studied by people inside of the police community and outside of it quite extensively. There are multiple federal reports making recommendations on what 21st century policing ought to look like that have been sort of given the endorsement of leading police agencies themselves, as well as community leaders. And then there is a wide body of literature examining at the very specific level how to train police, how to develop meaningful policies, how to create accountability mechanisms. But many of those things will require change. And that is difficult, and it's especially difficult when you're talking about 18,000 different agencies, most of which involve 10 or fewer officers. And many of our policing agencies could use the support of government agencies at the state and the federal level in order to have the resources to be able to contemplate what change looks like for their communities.
Cecilia, thanks so much for joining us again.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's Cecilia Klingel, expert on criminal justice policy at the UW Law School. She was with us today to talk about the Trump administration's record on policing and an executive order the president signed yesterday that incentivizes changes to police use of force.